I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. A 16-year-old sophomore has died after an altercation with fellow students inside a Wilmington, Delaware school bathroom. The incident took place this morning at the Howard High School of Technology. Avi Wolfman-Arendt has more from WHYY's Delaware desk.
Police say the female student was seriously assaulted at 8:15 a.m., shortly before school was set to begin. Howard Principal Stanley Spohr says the assault happened in a first-floor girls' bathroom. Wilmington police are interviewing two female students in connection with the assault. Both are believed to be Howard students. Police would not say what caused the incident or how the victim was injured. The victim, who was from Newcastle, Delaware, was airlifted to A.I. DuPont Children's Hospital, where she was declared dead. No official cause of death has been released. Wilmington Mayor Dennis Williams fought back tears while briefing reporters.
I am so upset that a young lady lost her life today. Things like this shouldn't happen.
Located on the edge of downtown Wilmington, Howard had been hailed in recent years for a dramatic school turnaround. Last year, then U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan visited the school to praise its progress. WHYY-TV was supposed to host a mayoral candidate debate on public safety at Howard High School tonight. That event will be rescheduled. From the Delaware desk, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
With Pennsylvania's primary looming next Tuesday, presidential candidates are being cited all over the Keystone State. Democrat Bernie Sanders has had three stops on his schedule today, with town halls in Scranton, Reading, and Oaks in Montgomery County. Bill Clinton was in Harrisburg to stump for his wife, Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton. Also in Harrisburg this evening is Republican candidate Donald Trump, holding a rally at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex. And Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich hosted a town hall meeting in Media, Pennsylvania today. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, he told the crowd he's got the level-headedness and experience to run the country well.
Kasich warmed up the crowd on Penn State Brandywine's campus with a mention of his alma mater, Ohio State University. That produced some friendly boos. Then he launched into a stump speech calling for lower taxes, improved national defense, and emphasizing that towns and communities should solve problems on a local level. In a not-so-veiled attack on Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, Kasich said he can offer solutions, not just vent frustration.
Anger sells. Strife sells. But that's not where we want to live, is it? I don't think so.
Glenside resident Laura Miller changed her party affiliation to Republican last month just so she could vote for Kasich. She says he's accomplished a lot as a governor and previously as a congressman.
Of course, Hillary Clinton has been willing to reach across the aisle, too. But there's a lot of lack of trustworthiness in regards to her, and I believe he's probably more honest.
Cliff Welby from South Philly had been leaning toward voting for Kasich, but the registered Democrat said the town hall changed his mind.
He reminds me of like a 1950s, oh golly gee, kind of guy, and I don't think he will stand a chance running against Hillary Clinton on the debate stage. I was just talking.
Pennsylvania and Delaware voters go to the polls on Tuesday. For WHYY News, I'm Joe Hernandez.
Tomorrow, a record 200 nations will mark the 46th anniversary of Earth Day, and the UN will start signing the climate treaty on that day as well. Mike Weilbacher, executive director of the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education, reflected on Earth Day's past and present with Newsworks Tonight host Dave Heller.
Mike, let's take it all the way back to 1970. Now, it didn't really start necessarily in Philadelphia. That wasn't the inception of the idea, but Philly played a big role.
Oh, huge. Yeah, so the Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson had the idea of taking the Vietnam War teach-in and transferring it to environmental issues. So he called for April 22nd to be a national teach-in on the environment. It quickly became translated into Earth Day. So a bunch of students at Penn grabbed onto it. Most of them were students of Ian McHarg, who, famous landscape architect, the father of ecological design, had just put a book out on that topic, the first one ever. So a bunch of his students began planning activities, and it was so ambitious that they decided, okay, we're going to do Earth Week. So they actually did Wednesday, April 22nd was a big day, 50,000 people on Belmont Plateau. The day before, 20,000 were in Independence Mall signing a declaration of interdependence. So 1 billion people are going to mark Earth Day. The UN is expecting something like 155 countries to sign the climate change treaty out of the 200 who said they would support it.
Though we can cite examples of successes toward that end, is it your assessment that overall we as people are kinder and more understanding and smarter stewards of the planet?
It's mixed. In 1970, there was such momentum behind environmental issues, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act. The EPA was created then. The National Environmental Policy Act was also created, which doesn't sound like anything to anybody until you know that that's authorizing impact statements, environmental impact statements, which had a huge effect in the field. So climate change was not on anybody's horizon at the time in 1970. Co-equal is the loss of the planet's biological diversity, that we're losing species, you know, by the minute. The issues have changed, but many noticeable advances were made in 1970s Earth Day, 1990s Earth Day, and hopefully in 2016s too. Coal companies are going bankrupt, go figure, while alternative energy companies are coming on strong and only going to be growing. So you see a shift in the economy to reflect the ecology, which makes sense. The question is, can we shift fast enough?
The shifting economy can also cause bumps of the negative kind. When we were mired in the depths of recession in 2008, often environmental concerns and the attendant costs go by the wayside.
Always. And that's been the 40-50-year conversation, ecology versus economy, and ecology loses. And I think, you know, there's a number of voices who say that both help each other, that we can't have a strong economy built on an environment that's falling apart. That conversation has happened so often in the last 50 years, but that we're still having it is disappointing for a lot of us.
Earth Day 2016. Yeah. What are the celebrations here in the Philadelphia region?
So my nature center, the Schuylkill Center, we're doing our Nature Palooza Earth Day Festival. It's the fifth annual. It's our single largest one-day event that we do. So nature walks, live animal shows, environmental art. But every organization of our size, every nature center, lots of parks are doing special things. The Clean Air Council does a big Earth Day run annually as well. So there's just literally thousands of events.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Dave.
Mike Weilbacher is executive director of the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education. We'll have a link at newsworks.org to that organization and lots of other options to celebrate that weekend as well.
Still ahead, how kosher food got its crossover appeal.
The owners, they are making, you know, manischewitz. We all know manischewitz, a sweet wine for Passover. And it starts to sell in the 40s for Christmas, for Easter, and for Thanksgiving. And they're trying to figure out what's going on.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Shai Benyakov, in for Dave Heller. Pennsylvania State Representative Dwight Evans is pinning much of his political future to what he's accomplished in one Philadelphia neighborhood, West Oak Lane. His work revitalizing the area is a big part of his run to replace indicted Philadelphia Congressman Shaka Fatah, whose federal corruption charges set the table for a crowded primary next Tuesday. If Evans is elected, he wants to use what he's learned in West Oak Lane to help transform struggling neighborhoods in other parts of the city, one block at a time. WHYY's Aaron Mosell has more.
On a wet April morning, Paul Beal's Flowers buzzes with activity. His grandson and another employee are busy with arrangements. His daughter is handling the front counter and the phones.
This is the beginning of the year, yes. The proms, weddings, funerals, of course, always.
The shop opened on Ogontz Avenue in the early 70s when all kinds of businesses packed the commercial corridor.
Ogontz and Tubahawken was a pharmacy there. On across the corner was a movie theater. Coming up this way towards my store from Tubahawken, there was a shoe store, so I can go on and on.
But just a few years later, Beal could count the remaining businesses on one hand. He says many white-owned shops moved out as more and more African-Americans moved in. blight followed. Beal says things didn't get better until a 25-year-old community activist became a state representative. Beal says Evans immediately got to work and never stopped.
Dwight brought it back. Is that something? With hard work and determination?
Beal isn't the only one that praises Evans' work in West Oak Lane. Talk to almost anyone who lived in the neighborhood before he was elected, and they'll tell you it would be a different place, likely a worse place if he hadn't come along. Where others saw decay, Evans saw potential.
And how that I knew the potential was there? Because abandonment wasn't a big problem. There wasn't a lot of houses that was abandoned, first and foremost. Secondly, the people who were in the houses had jobs. And it was here in a great location. It borders Montgomery County.
Evans' first order of business was attracting stores to anchor Ogontz Avenue. He hoped they'd encourage other businesses to set up shop. At the time, well over half of the storefronts along the avenue were vacant. Evans says he got a Rite Aid pharmacy to move in and convinced a state liquor store to relocate.
And the phrase was, something's happening in West Oak Lane. That was the theme. And it was a coming back. It was about repositioning West Oak Lane as a community that was on a rise and a rebirth.
Over 10 years, Evans steered $30 million to West Oak Lane through the Ogontz Avenue Revitalization Corporation, which he founded back in the 1980s. It wasn't dumb luck. By then, Evans was the Democratic chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. It wasn't hard for him to steer dollars to his district, prompting some Philadelphia lawmakers to nickname him Mr. ATM. Suburban State Rep. Greg Vitale served on the Appropriations Committee with Evans. He says he didn't have a problem with the funds Evans secured for Philadelphia. To him, the city needed them, badly. He says others probably felt differently.
If you're from the other part of the state not getting the benefit of this money, I'm sure there's a sense of a resentment. But, you know, that's the struggle of politics.
In 2010, that struggle may have cost Evans his chairmanship on the Appropriations Committee, a post he held for two decades.
I have no apologies about what I tried to do. It was open. It was transparent. It was accountable. You know, all of it was accountable. There was no question about how I conducted myself.
The same can't be said for the Ogontz Avenue nonprofit Evans founded. In 2013, the organization had to return more than $1 million in public money and withdraw four grant requests following a state probe into allegations of financial mismanagement. Afterwards, Evans called the investigation a case of political profiling. He says the episode doesn't undermine the narrative he helped write in West Oak Lane.
Now, I'm not trying to avoid this. Not everything that's perfect, but I will say this to you. You want to match up West Oak Lane and any other neighborhood in this congressional district that's been transformed in the last 25, 30 years? I don't think anybody else can show or demonstrate.
Evans is not running to keep his seat in Harrisburg, and so if he loses Tuesday, it could be the end of his political career. If he wins, he would be in line to become a 62-year-old freshman congressman in a body that rewards seniority. That doesn't bother Evans.
That's a perfect argument made by those who sit in status quo, right? And who don't want to do anything. Somebody like myself has been just the opposite, has always been pushing the envelope.
Pushing to turn potential into positive change, however long it takes. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Passover begins this Friday at sunset, which means Jewish households are stocked with foods deemed kosher for Passover. But history has shown that you don't necessarily have to keep kosher to enjoy the range of kosher foods available in supermarkets. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with food historian Roger Horowitz about his latest book, Kosher USA, How Coke Became Kosher and Other Tales of Modern Food, which follows kosher's move to mainstream in America. They began their conversation by pinpointing the product that started it all.
Manischewitz wine. That's the first product which you could say crosses over from the kosher world into the non-kosher world.
Serendipitously, or was it specifically targeted beyond
it's
those
a total
who keep
surprise.
Kosher?
The owners, they are making, you know, Manischewitz. We all know Manischewitz, a sweet wine for Passover. And it starts to sell in the 40s for Christmas, for Easter, and for Thanksgiving. And they're trying to figure out what's going on. Turns out African Americans who moved to the North during World War II start buying Manischewitz New York City, Detroit, Los Angeles, Boston. It becomes a wine that by the mid-50s is predominantly African-American in its consumer base. Complete surprise.
Now let's talk to the teetotalers, Coke.
Coca-Cola. 1930s, lots of Jews are drinking Coca-Cola. But was it kosher? So rabbis start to look into this issue, and the major person in that process is a man named Rabbi Tobias Geffen, Atlanta rabbi, and that's where Coke made. And in the tradition of Judaism and Jewish law, you go to the rabbi in the place where the product is being made. Geffen looks into it, and he goes, sorry, it's not kosher.
Why?
It has this ingredient in it called glycerin, and it ends up in a lot of drinks because it helps flavor diffuse evenly through the liquid. And there's a little bit of pork fat in it. So Geffen looks into this and he says, can't have it. So he goes to Coke. Coke goes to their supplier, Procter & Gamble, and they find a way to make glycerin that comes from vegetable sources. And with that, Geffen's able to get Coke to change the recipe, and that allows Coke to become kosher.
This book is in large measure a personal account, and let's note that this was written during a very tough time in your life.
Well, it starts because of a question from my Uncle Stu, who asks me, what about kosher meat? And then he dies. I can't talk to him about it. My mother relays the question. I thought, that's a darn good question. And as I started to write the book, I get into these conversations with my mother and father about their experiences as children, about parents. And then, I have to say, in the middle of the book, my parents pass away. And so these stories that I get from them are powerful, and they're in the book because they were such vivid experiences. I begin the chapter on kosher slaughter, which is about ethics, describing showing my mother the biopic about Temple Grandin, because Temple Grandin is quietly yet central to the developments in kosher slaughter, which makes it more ethical.
She is on the autism spectrum and serves as a consultant in agribusiness.
And you probably don't know how important she is in kosher meat. Because she doesn't talk about that. She just takes care of it. What happens with kosher meat is this. There's a lot of concern by animal rights people that kosher slaughter is not humane. Because under the religious rules, the animal has to be conscious at the time that it's killed. That's to make sure it's not damaged, which of course is an issue in the meat industry today. Temple Grandin gets involved in this debate in the 70s. She looks at what's happening in these kosher slaughter plants. She is appalled at what's going on. And she figures out a technology on how to do it better. She persuades the Orthodox Union, it's extraordinary, that this is indeed is an appropriate way. And she and the Orthodox Union go around to meatpacking plants in the 80s and the 90s, and they change the way kosher slaughter is done.
How so?
Well, the issue there is how the animal is restrained. And she figures out a way to restrain the animal gently and to hold it firmly so it doesn't even feel the knife.
Can that method, though, be adopted to mainstream slaughterhouses?
It certainly could. There's only one problem with it, though. It's slow. And it's slow because the animal has to stand there until it falls unconscious. It can't be grabbed by the rear leg and pulled down a line semi-conscious, as still has happened sometimes in meatpacking plants, before it actually dies.
Kosher USA, How Coke Became Kosher and Other Tales of Modern Food, the latest book from food historian Roger Horowitz. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org.
Finally tonight, big news in the currency world came yesterday when the United States Treasury announced it was replacing Andrew Jackson's portrait on the $20 bill with that of anti-slavery activist Harriet Tubman. But changes are also coming to the $10 and $5 bills, and they have connections to the Philadelphia area. The back of the $10 bill shows a group of women central to the suffrage movement, including abolitionist Lucretia Mott, who was a Philadelphia resident and helped establish the American Anti-Slavery Society in 1833. She was also one of the founders of Swarthmore College in suburban Philadelphia. Alice Paul, born in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, will also be featured on the back of the bill. Opera singer Marian Anderson will join Martin Luther King Jr. and Eleanor Roosevelt on the back of the $5 bill. Anderson was born in Philadelphia, and when she was denied access to music school because of the color of her skin, the community raised the funds needed for private classes. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by myself and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Stay with WHYY this evening at 8 p.m. following Fresh Air for a debate with the five candidates vying to replace Kathleen Kane as Pennsylvania's Attorney General. Thanks for joining us. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov for NewsWorks Tonight.